with his whole heart, he makes God his reliable support. In fact, the concept of tawakkul finds meaning when a person reaches a stage of knowledge and belief that he or she understands that everything is from God, and that if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants good for someone, no one can prevent it. And if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants bad for him, no one can prevent it too. So accordingly, he considers money, wealth, wife, children, and etc. bestowed by God. Thank you very much, and I hope you have enjoyed this episode. And until another one, I bid you farewell, and may Allah protect you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm Saeed Pourizza, with you for some of the biggest talking points coming out of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and its ongoing raids in the West Bank. First off, a reminder of the most recent developments. Dozens of Palestinians killed, dozens more wounded in the latest attack on Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. The humanitarian crisis is deepening as nearly 2 million displaced Palestinians are having to cope with scarce tents, food, and water. Oxfam and Human Rights Watch accuse the Israeli regime of using hunger as a weapon of war. In what looks like an escalation, Israel has targeted Hezbollah positions in southern Lebanon. Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas's political office, is in the Egyptian capital Cairo in what could signal a new phase of possible truce negotiations. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council has postponed a vote on a draft resolution to halt the fighting until December 20th. In the UK, a number of senior conservative MPs are piling the pressure on the Prime Minister to back an immediate ceasefire in the coastal enclave. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has killed at least 19,667 Palestinians since October 7th. Hundreds more have been murdered in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem in the same period. So where do things stand right now? Are we on the cusp of another ceasefire despite intensified Israeli strikes? What's the plan for post-onslaught Gaza? And has the genocide in Gaza brought Palestinian factions closer or not? Let's tackle those questions with Tariq Othman here in the studio with me. Tariq is a London-based Palestinian who has family in the West Bank. Alongside him, via Skype, also from London, academic and analyst Ibrahim Jamal. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. Tariq, let me begin with you, just to kick things off. Your thoughts on the fact that 2.5 months later, since it all began, we're here talking about the ongoing genocide, that it's taken so long for the world leaders to begin to talk about a longer truce.
Well, there's a lot of mixed feelings about it. Of course, the fact that, you know, 75 days or so now after the beginning of a mass slaughter, a mass starvation of 2 million people, it's still to the point where calling for a ceasefire is, you know, just about on the cusp of what is politically mainstream. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I do think that it shows a great resilience on the part of the Palestinian people to have survived what I don't think anyone, and me firstly, would be able to survive. I think something like 50% of the people in Gaza are currently starving. And yet we still see that after 75 days of that, there is still resistance, there is still community, and there are still some very awe-inspiring visions and videos coming out from Gaza. And so there, in a sense, it's instilled me with a sense of pride because of the fact that we have been able to maintain that.
Let me put the same question to Ibrahim as well. Your thoughts, Ibrahim, on the fact, again, that 2.5 months since it all started, we're still seeing that genocide unfold before the eyes of the world, with countries that can put an end to it right now if they wanted to, but won't.
Yes, more than 18,000 have been killed, including 7,700 children. We've seen bombs dropped on hospitals, schools, religious sites, mosques, churches. But more than that, the nature has changed. We've seen journalists being targeted. We've seen an elderly woman and her daughter being sniped in a Catholic church in Gaza City. We've seen high-ranking officials, yes, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, as well as Pope Francis, I believe. We've seen high-ranking Israeli officials, including Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, and Energy Minister Israel Katz. They've made public statements expressing their aim to deprive civilians of food, water, electricity, and fuel. This constitutes two crimes of humanity. These are war crimes, and under the statute, Article 7 of the Rome Statute, so these are in direct contravention of international law and standards, and it is a crime against humanity.
And Ibrahim, let me ask a second question. While, for example, the likes of Ben-Gvir, Itamar Ben-Gvir in the Israeli cabinet, are calling for quote-unquote military decisiveness, which means basically continuing with the slaughter of Palestinians, the president is saying that Israel is open to a ceasefire and a prisoner and captive exchange. What do you think is happening in the so-called war cabinet in the Israeli regime?
Well, the war cabinet, the individual leading them is Netanyahu. This is a man who's been charged with corruption, embezzlement. His wife, according to original indictments against Sarah Netanyahu, she's been indicted of a fraud and breach of trust. Yeah. So she also embezzled around $100,000. They were filmed dining at a non-kosher restaurant in London, Gordon Ramsay's, whilst passing a law to prohibit hospitals giving out a particular type of bread in hospitals. So we're dealing with a hypocrite. We're talking about someone who embezzles and corrupts. And this is supposedly the leader of those that he serves. So he's absorbed these terrorists and criminals to form a coalition government. And more than that, the Israeli government, the Israeli people have voted for him. According to a recent poll, 60% of Jewish Israelis, the IDF is not using sufficient force. So everything that we've seen is not enough. And the most telling and the biggest indication is when we heard of three Israeli hostages who were practically naked, holding out under a white banner of surrender
and speaking
Hebrew. Exactly. So what more defenseless individuals could you face for them to be gunned down? What more do you want? So those are those people. Imagine the Palestinians who are in a school. You've got snipers waiting outside. And these are all under the orders of the war cabinet.
Yeah. You mentioned snipers, Tariq. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we have family in the West Bank. This is an atrocity, an aggression that is not limited to the Gaza Strip. There are snipers in the West Bank, the occupied East Jerusalem as well. What are you hearing from your loved ones who live there as we speak?
There's a great sense of anxiety because it's a situation now where many of the Palestinians are extremely fearful of the settlers who live near them, who, enabled by the Israeli occupational army, are carrying out You know, they're carrying out, you know, slaughters of Palestinians. They will ransack villages. They will destroy homes and cars, and they will attack random civilians and their farmland. But more than that, there's been a great increase in the confiscation of land. There's been an increase in the demolishment of homes that Palestinians have built, and there's an increase in the ethnic cleansing of many Palestinian communities, especially near around Hebron and Safariyatta. Mm-hmm. And in these areas, Palestinians now faced with increased Israeli terror, which are acting on the basis that the media has focused on Gaza and so therefore allowed them to get away with much more. And the settlements, of course, are not slowing down whatsoever. In fact, they're increasing.
Recently they announced funding for the building of another settlement.
Yeah, so there's, you know, Palestinians in real time in the West Bank are seeing their freedoms of movement controlled by Israel. Many Palestinians and many Palestinian villages are completely isolated from villages 1 mile away and cannot move, cannot go out to get food and water. Palestinians in villages like Jenin have faced daily raids where, you know, dozens have been killed in a single day. And that's, of course, in the West Bank, where Hamas does not have any strongholds. Hamas does not have major political control.
Yeah.
And it shows, I think, a large-scale domination campaign carried out by Israel, and that has been carried out, of course, for the last 75 years.
Mm-hmm. And all, of course, with the blessing of its Western backers, about which one we're going to hear. The U.S. is still engaging constructively, quote-unquote, with other members of the U.N. Security Council on the text of an Arab-sponsored resolution to spur desperately needed humanitarian aid deliveries to Gaza during a halt in the fighting. Of course, that according to a UN State Department spokesman. UN Security Council members were in intense negotiations Tuesday on a resolution trying to avoid another veto by the U.S. The vote, postponed till December 20th, had been expected to take place by early afternoon on December 19th, but was later canceled as the U.S. asked for more time. The State Department spokesman also reiterated Washington's new position against settler terrorism in the occupied territories. Have a listen.
We are engaging constructively with our colleagues on the Security Council to resolve outstanding issues related to that resolution. We fully support addressing the humanitarian needs of the people of Gaza, as this resolution should set out to do, and we're working through these issues with other countries on the Security Council. We have made very clear to Israel that we think they need to do more to police and prevent extremist settler violence in the West Bank, and we have taken our own actions to hold extremist settlers accountable when they commit violent actions, and we will continue to do that. We will continue to speak both loudly from here about it and directly to Israel.
Matthew Miller there, the U.S. State Department spokesman. Tara, I think I want to put this other question to you as well. One of the things we heard the Americans say was they're going to impose sanctions on settlers for committing violence against the Palestinians. Probably a lot of them already have American passports. I wonder if those sanctions work. The UK has said something along those lines. How do we square that with their billions of dollars in military funding to Israel and their diplomatic backing and all of that?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that it's a vain attempt to save face in a way and to pretend as if they are making constructive efforts. Of course, they are militarily backing Israel, and they are sending, you know, arms that are, as we speak, being used to bomb civilian targets in Gaza. But more than that, I think I don't know how many people it will affect, because in order to subscribe someone to be a terrorist, there are, you know, in Israel, you'd expect courts to decide that and to delineate someone as an extremist.
Mm-hmm.
But in Israel, the courts will not do that. You know, I believe something like 93% of cases opened against extremist settlers in the West Bank are closed without even an indictment, never mind a charge or a conviction. So what we are seeing is this will not have any effect whatsoever, and it's really an attempt to placate people who maybe aren't as aware.
And Ibrahim, same question to you. maybe UK-related. We saw that resolution, that amendment to the King's Speech brought forth by the SNP, the Scottish National Party, for calling for a ceasefire, was struck down by the Conservative Party, of course, along with members of the Labour Party. And yet you hear comments such as the ones we heard from Foreign Secretary Lord David Cameron, saying the same thing as the Americans have said, that they're going to slap sanctions on Jewish settlers.
Yeah, these leaders, which they don't deserve to be called leaders, both in name and position, they are sheeps in sheep clothing. The Israeli lobby is very powerful and organized. I don't know what it is that they hold on them, blackmail or whatever it is, for them to be complying with them and just unconditionally supporting them. I wonder to what extent, you know, what has to be done for them to say no. And it just seems to me that the only thing that trumps their loyalty to Israel is their loyalty to themselves. I mean, countries in America and here at the UK, there is no shortage of problems that we face. We're talking about homelessness, accommodation, we're talking about immigration, crime, stabbings. All of that has been set aside, and they use our tax money to support a criminal entity. Yeah. I just don't understand. I'm flabbergasted, and I don't know what it's going to take for people or for these leaders to put a stop to this, dealing with Israel. You know, basic stuff like stop sending arms and why allow? I don't understand why
Israeli,
we allow
weapons manufacturers out of the United Kingdom. That's one way to do
yes,
it.
Yes, but more than that, why is it that we have UK dual nationals, you know, going over to Israel, and these are people that support crimes against humanity and have committed war crimes, serving in the IDF or being spokespersons, yet a Palestinian faces so many obstacles going over to his homeland, to his ancestral land, and if they do give any money or funds, they're labeled as terrorist sympathizers or fundraisers for terrorists.
Exactly.
I don't understand.
Yeah, it does defy belief. It really does boggle the mind. Tarek, I want to pivot to the humanitarian crisis. People, of course, are being bombed 24/7. Mm-hmm. People are dying as we're speaking. Mm-hmm. But the humanitarian situation, the catastrophe, is deepening.
Yes.
By the day. Oxfam, Human Rights Watch, we'll be talking about this, of course, later on as well, have accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war.
Yes.
What do you think is the thinking, really, in Israel behind denying people food and water and electricity and supplies such as that?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question to answer. There are a couple, I think, possible explanations. The first is that the Israelis on October 7th went through a very big shock in a lot of ways. And many Israeli civilians did die. And to Israelis, in order to have a sense of victory, many of them, and this has been very clear from videos that have come out of Israel, do feel the need that they need to inflict 100 times greater pain against the Palestinians in an act of collective punishment, in order to perhaps, you know, as one Israeli commentator has said, in order to sleep at night, he wants to see houses of civilians.
To kill 100,000
Yes,
we've all
exactly.
seen that video.
Yeah, it's unfortunately very commonplace, and I doubt that commentator is going to have any repercussions for what he said. Mm-hmm. And another explanation, of course, is that the resistance amongst Palestinians, in all forms of resistance, is so entrenched that in order to stem resistance and in order to impose your domination against the Palestinians, you need to in essentially cut off the basics of life in order to then cut off the basics of resistance. So far that hasn't worked. And the past 75 years of the ethnic cleansing hasn't worked in stemming Palestinians away from confronting their occupiers. But it does seem that in the Israeli mindset, and in fact in the mindset of a lot of occupiers and colonizers throughout history, has been to confront any opposition to them with demonstrable violence.
And brute force.
Brute force.
And you know what? It's been the occupiers and the colonizers who had to leave in the very end.
I think that's what's given me a lot of hope. We've lived through 75 years of, you know, perhaps not as bloody, but definitely the same mentality.
Yeah.
And just as, you know, approximately half of the Palestinians today might be expelled from Gaza, and that's their, of course, their intention. We've already, half of the Palestinians have already been expelled in 1948.
Yeah.
You know, thousands of Palestinians have already been dying. So this is really just more of the same in that sense. And in that sense, I do feel like just as we've survived that and we've come back and we've, you know, cemented our identity, this too will only cement our identity and cement our love for our land.
We're seeing that playing out every single day. Now, Ibrahim, we see there, with that contribution earlier, that resistance and solidarity are coming in many different forms. What would you say, if anything, to someone who wants to get involved in the pro-Palestine movement but is afraid of the potential blowback?
Yes, that poem was eloquent and moving. So someone who wants to get involved, I would say write petition your local council. You can also download apps like No Thanks. This is an app that lists boycotted products, any products that are affiliated with Israel. So what you do is you would scan the barcode and it will automatically tell you if it supports Israel by giving funds, if it's complicit or not. More than that, the app, you can donate money. Now, I've got friends in Gaza and they are in dire need of assistance, food and water. But when I did go to give money, he told me, you know, there is no food. So what are we going to do with the money? So before anything, something has to change on the ground. And attending protests, raising funds, these are all ways that we can show, we can convert our emotions into political action. They do have a place and they do matter.
Absolutely. And Tariq, in addition to what we heard Ibrahim say, there are other people who are saying one of the ways to keep the pressure on the government to take some kind of action would be to take direct action.
Yeah.
As we have seen groups such as Palestine Action do so, which was to lay siege to Elbit Systems, the Israeli weapons manufacturer that has several sites in the UK, to their sites and try to shut them down.
Yeah.
And they have managed to do so
in
the case of two. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's very inspiring. I have to one of those particular sites. I was there with a Palestine Action allied group. It wasn't Palestine Action themselves, but it was the same sort of idea. And I saw with my own eyes how effective it was. You know, we're at the point now where no single one of us is going to have the ability to single-handedly end the genocide. But there's a very interesting quote that I've heard that I always think about, and it's, "I can't do anything alone," said 7 billion people, and that's the idea. And there's a lot, I think, you know, popular movements and movements directly targeting factories, for example. I mean, factories shut down for a day, that's one day's less of drones or sniper scopes that haven't been made. And on top of that, I think it's more than that, more than whether it's effective. It's, you know, what kind of person would you be if you slept through a genocide?
Exactly.
Whether it's effective or not, doing something, doing interviews, protesting, doing direct action, for me at least, is what allows me to is what I think I'll be able to say maybe in 10, 20 years when I've had my own children. I'll be able to say, you know, your dad wasn't entirely useless.
Or I did what I could in my capacity to bring about change.
Exactly.
One thing I've heard, Ibrahim, is pro-Israel commentators and others calling into question the accounts that are being provided by the different UN bodies, the so-called Professor Alan Dershowitz of the University of Harvard, if I'm not wrong, saying the Red Cross, UNICEF, UNRWA, they're all in the pockets of Hamas, in not in his exact words, but you know that's pretty much what he was trying to say. Why do you think they're doing that, discounting and undermining the accounts of the scale of death and destruction coming out of the Gaza Strip?
Their rhetoric has become much more extreme. You know, anyone that's against them and anyone that's not with them is against them and is a Hamas sympathizer. Also, the medium in which people consume news now, before where in the past it was just through the television. Now we've got social media, we've got people with phones, and you've also got Israeli soldiers showcasing their depravity to the world and smiling about it. So these are undeniable truths, and people resonate when they see individuals being massacred. Gaza has lived through, I think, four wars previous to this. Each one has gotten worse, and the population has become younger and younger. Mm-hmm. And the rhetoric of people like Alan Dershowitz is that Hamas recruits child soldiers, and the fault is on Hamas. So, and we see a shift in their rhetoric becoming more extreme, you know, and these are, they don't hold up to academic scrutiny. Never mind.
Now, like you say, they make those comments because they have no argument. They have lost the argument. All right, fascinating conversation, gentlemen. We're fresh out of time. With those comments, we're going to wrap this show up. Many thanks again to my guests for their contributions. Gaza Under Attack will be back with more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
From the heart of beauty. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Hunter Biden was indicted on 9 tax charges in California on Thursday, 7th of December, as a special counsel investigation into the business dealings of President Biden's son intensifies against the backdrop of a looming 2024 election. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CNN cable news network has covered this story and tells us more. Hunter Biden has been charged in connection with a long-running Justice Department investigation into his taxes, the second criminal case that special counsel David Weiss has brought against President Joe Biden's son. The charges span 9 counts, including failure to file and pay taxes, evasion of assessment, and false or fraudulent tax return. CNN was first to report a new criminal case had been filed. According to the special counsel's team, Hunter Biden engaged in a four-year scheme to not pay at least $1.4 million in taxes that he owed from 2016 through to 2019. Though Hunter Biden did eventually pay his taxes from 2018, prosecutors allege that he included false business deductions in order to evade assessment of taxes to reduce the substantial tax liabilities that he faced. Prosecutors also allege in the 56-page indictment that he subverted the payroll and tax withholding process of his own company by withdrawing millions of dollars outside of its payroll and tax withholding process. The president's son spent millions of dollars on an extravagant lifestyle rather than paying his tax bills, according to the indictment, which states, between 2016 and 15th of October 2020, the defendant spent his money on drugs, escorts and girlfriends, luxury hotels and rental properties, exotic cars, clothing and other items of a personal nature, in short, everything but his taxes. The indictment also referenced Hunter Biden's 2021 memoir, Beautiful Things, in which he detailed some of his personal struggles with addiction and substance abuse. He was paid more than $140,000 related to the book from January through to October of 2020, according to the indictment. Hunter Biden's attorney, Abby Lowell, said in a statement that based on the facts and the law, if Hunter's last name was anything other than Biden, the charges in Delaware and now in California would not have been brought against him. First, U.S. Attorney David Weiss bowed to Republican pressure to file unprecedented and unconstitutional gun charges to renege on a non-prosecution resolution. Now, after 5 years of investigating with no new evidence, and 2 years after Hunter Biden paid his taxes in full, the U.S. attorney has piled on 9 new charges when he had agreed just months ago to resolve this matter with a pair of misdemeanors, he continued. Lowell had sent a letter to David Weiss on Tuesday asking to speak with prosecutors before any additional charging decisions are made. He said in his Thursday statement that the customary meeting to discuss this investigation did not occur. Asked for comment, the White House referenced CNN to the Justice Department and Hunter Biden's representatives. In a news release announcing the charges on Thursday, 7th of December, the Justice Department said Hunter Biden could face a maximum of 17 years in prison if convicted of the charges. The case had been close to being resolved in July when a plea deal fell apart. The new tax case stems from Hunter Biden's lucrative overseas business dealings, including his involvement with Ukrainian energy company Burisma and a Chinese private equity fund, which are at the center of House Republicans' impeachment inquiry into his father, Joe Biden. Now the president will be campaigning for a second White House term and fighting a Republican impeachment bid while his son fights to avoid prison in 2 criminal cases. According to court filings from the now-defunct plea deal, Hunter Biden repeatedly missed IRS deadlines to pay his federal taxes on time and eventually owed about $2 million to the government. He paid the money back in 2021 with a loan from a friend. Federal prosecutors have been scrutinizing Hunter Biden's finances since 2018, and Trump-appointed U.S. Attorney David Weiss was designated special counsel in August. The probe appeared to be winding down this summer when Hunter Biden agreed to plead guilty to 2 tax misdemeanors and prosecutors would recommend no jail time. They also agreed that a gun charge would be dropped in 2 years if he stayed out of legal trouble. But both proposed deals collapsed after scrutiny from a federal judge and disagreements over the fine print. Then David Weiss indicted Hunter Biden in September on 3 charges relating to the purchase of a gun from a shop in Delaware in 2018, at a time prosecutors say he was an illegal drug user. Hunter Biden's attorneys previously accused David Weiss of bending to political pressure from Republicans and said his actions present a grave threat to our system of justice. One of the reasons Republicans have attacked David Weiss is because of testimony from two IRS whistleblowers who were involved in the probe and said they witnessed political interference by the Justice Department. The whistleblowers said career IRS agents recommended felony tax charges against Hunter Biden in early 2022. David Weiss and Attorney General Merrick Garland have refuted the whistleblowers' claims. The website politico.com has also covered this story and tells us more. A federal grand jury in California has indicted Hunter Biden on 9 charges, including 3 felonies for failing to pay his taxes, understating his income and exaggerating his expenses on tax return forms between 2016 and 2019. With separate criminal charges against him pending in Delaware for illegally possessing a gun, the president's son could face 2 criminal trials next year as his father runs for re-election against Donald Trump, who himself is facing 4 criminal cases. The Hunter Biden cases were brought by special counsel David Weiss, the Delaware prosecutor who has long supervised the federal probe into president's son. The new charges include tax evasion, filing false tax returns, failure to file returns on time, and failing to pay federal taxes. They carry a maximum possible prison term of 17 years, although defendants typically get shorter sentences under federal guidelines. Each of the tax charges accuses Hunter Biden of acting willfully, something his defense is sure to contest, since he has acknowledged struggling for years with drug addiction. Prosecutors acknowledge those issues at points in the indictment, but say Biden spent lavishly on an extravagant lifestyle while shirking on his taxes, including paying for drugs, escorts and girlfriends, luxury hotels and rental properties, exotic cars, clothing and other items of a personal nature. After 5 years of investigating with no new evidence and 2 years after Hunter Biden paid his taxes in full, the U.S. attorney has piled on 9 new charges, when he had agreed just months ago to resolve this matter with a pair of misdemeanors. Hunter Biden's attorney, Abby Lowell, said in a statement. The statement added, "I wrote U.S. Attorney David Weiss days ago seeking a customary meeting to discuss this investigation. The response was media leaks today that these charges were being filed." The charges come amid an effort by House Republicans to link President Joe Biden to his son's business dealings as part of an impeachment inquiry, though the inquiry has produced no evidence so far that Joe Biden took any action as president or vice president to corruptly enrich his family.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we are going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. And today we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So we will begin with the first question, where someone asked, how does one prevent their child from telling other secrets about their home?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Actually, first of all, we should not expect a child not to tell secrets around. There's nothing like the concept of secret in a child's mind. A child has very low retention to not speak out what he knows. So we as parents should be careful of what to speak near the child, first of all. Okay. Child does not understand the concept of secret. You know, for him, it's just something new that he learned and he's finding people to say, you know, to relate to. So the more I feel you stress about this fact that don't tell, you know, the more vicious a person becomes that now he needs to tell, and especially if it's a child.
True.
You know,
Is there a specific age you're talking about?
No, actually, secrets to anyone, even to adults. You go and see, men are less retainers of secrets than women. Women can keep secrets if you tell them not to tell someone.
Really?
But men will tell. It's okay. Like, you know, the story of a woman being bought, a beautiful necklace, and she told the husband that, please, no, don't tell anyone. And the next meeting that they had with the mother-in-law, he tells that, you know, I bought for my wife this necklace. Then she tells him that, why couldn't you keep this secret? So men, you know, they can't keep secrets. It's not their fault. They just can't keep secrets as much as a woman.
Okay.
But a woman needs to be told not to keep that secret.
That's
but child,
very
he has very low retention ability, so he can't even keep that much as a secret. Like if you know, parents are discussing about their trips or anything that they would like to do and go ahead, and they're talking in front of maybe a 5-year-old, and the husband tells the wife that this Eid we will visit Mashhad.
Yeah.
But let's keep this just now, you know, to ourselves as a secret. They tell the child that just now, then nothing is confirmed. So please don't tell anyone.
True.
And the next time he sees his grandparents, he tells them that, you know, we are deciding to go to Mashhad.
I think it's like whenever a child is nearby, we always say little ears are hearing. Because
yeah, exactly.
We know that the child is hearing, they keep in and take in everything very fast.
Yeah. So it's better to rather than telling them that why did you break the secret or why did you telling around and things like that. It's better for us to be careful as parents not to say everything near a child. That's very important.
So yeah, it's very important. We're just going to take a short break, inshallah, and we'll be back for more on this after the break. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing.
Something that is only necessary to be discussed alone should be discussed alone. Something to be discussed with a child should be discussed with a child. It doesn't mean that they're behaving badly or something like that. It's just their nature. As children grow up, then they know the concept of secret, and that even not some secret that would involve, you know, backbiting or malice of someone. No,
yeah.
It's something that, you know, it's your own personal matter. They'll come to understand.
I think that's very interesting because usually we feel, oh, it's the child that's doing wrong. You know, we should tell them off.
Yeah.
But it's a good
child is innocent.
Yeah, it's a good side that you've shown us that actually sometimes we have to be the ones careful not to tell things near the child where the things that we don't want others to know.
Yeah, exactly.
Usually we end up, you know, scolding the child while
it's not his
fault
at all. Yeah.
So
we should be careful and not speak in front of the child all the things that are supposed to. They are not like yet confirmed or something that the child needs not to know. A child is pure. in the heart, and he wants to just share it out, and wants to just what he learned, he wants to, you know, like relate it, articulate it, things like that. So,
and is it good to tell the child, maybe, you know,
keep the secret?
Yeah, keep the secret, or don't tell anybody. Like, that's okay to do, right?
Well, you know, as the child understands the concept of secret, maybe you can try with the harmless things, because it's important to keep your own secrets and people's secrets also.
True.
Because you raise a manadar child, a trustworthy and person who is able to keep people's words, not just keep on telling things. So it's good to test a child, but with harmless things, you know, maybe a surprise for the sibling, that, you know, there's a surprise cake, but keep it a secret. Then watch whether they can retain the secret or not. This won't harm somebody. It'll just make a person feel happier, you know.
Very true.
But these, then you can know that he has the, you know, retention ability. He can keep secrets, or she can keep secrets. Then you go to such things. But never speak personal matters together, like, you know, that a child doesn't feel like hearing, or doesn't need to hear, or doesn't have to hear, things like
that. Very true. Thank you so much. That was very interesting. We would love to continue this discussion, but let us just stop for a short break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
So we're back on IRIB English Radio, where we were discussing about how to prevent a child from spreading secrets. And Sister Salma, you told us some very interesting points, one of which I found was very, interesting, was that we shouldn't tell the secrets out loud if we don't want the child to spread it because they are young. So if you don't mind, we would like to go to the next question.
Yes, sure.
Where somebody has said, "I have an 11-year-old who doesn't like studying. I always end up forcing him, and this raises so many arguments between us. Is there any way to avoid this?"
Yes, this is a very good question, because at all ages, if you go and see, parents face this problem, not only at 11-year-old. It begins like maybe at 7, 8, 9. But here we are going to realize that if we force, it never works out for children. In fact, for adults also, you know, when they're at a level that they can study, if you force them to study, they'll say, "I just don't feel like it."
Yeah.
So the best thing is, first of all, we should realize the biggest mistakes teachers and parents make when it comes to developing students and children who are very good learners is to limit their learning to just the classroom.
Very true.
We think that the classroom is likely to be a primary source of education if you want to truly enhance your child's desire and ability to learn. It's a good, you know, learning area. But we can't develop a child in all the levels, if you go and see, intellectual, social, academic, sports.
Exactly.
In a classroom only.
It's very limited.
It's so limited. If, for example, you know, parents, they're so strict, they don't even travel sometimes. They get opportunities to travel with their children, and they don't know in the process the child will learn so much in the midst of this traveling.
Very true.
And if we go and see ourselves, if we learned in the classroom, how much is it helping us now? Apart from some vocabulary that we know in geography and history and science, if we don't want to take up the field.
Yeah.
Of course, it makes us very much broad-minded. It's very good to read, to know about some facts. But if we didn't keep up through that reading, we read for exams only. Yeah?
Very true.
But
yeah.
How much has it benefited us in other areas, apart from the classrooms, social gatherings, you know, like if you go and see the Azadari gatherings, have given us too much more than even school.
Yeah, I think the surrounding has to be made such that, you know, a child would like to, you know, explore all his talents, all his abilities, capabilities.
That's right.
And a school sometimes just limits them to, you know, studying and memorizing things and, you know, just
looking up for grades.
Yeah, just getting that A star or that B, the 20 out of 20, which is a pity. Then you kind of prevent the child from reaching his full potential.
Yeah, exactly. He's so limited in that area, and his mind gets closed to just receiving that and what the people's reactions would be, you know. So first of all, regarding this question, let's look at why children don't feel like studying in the first place.
Yeah.
Why children don't feel like studying is, first of all, they're either very smart children, They feel, what for studying? There's no motivation in them, you know?
Mm.
Okay, I know I'll get good grades, so why study? They don't know that studying has more than good grades in that. When you study, you polish your mind. When you study, you feel happy to gain knowledge. When you study, you know about the facts of life. When you study, you can keep on furthering your abilities to study and to develop in that field. So you can do so much more. And if you're smart and you're studying, you can grow potentially, actually in such a way that you can become, you know, you can get a very good career in future and you can be of benefit to the society. So studying is not limited to just getting grades the way a smart boy feels that, okay? Either they're smart so they don't feel like studying.
Yeah.
Maybe we have put in their minds, okay, my child is smart, he doesn't need to study. That's not all for studying as you know, as it should be. Studying has so many divine good benefits also.
So please tell us, what is the reason why a child doesn't study?
First of all, maybe the child is too smart. But we said smartness is not the fact that it should stop a child from studying more. And it should not even make the parent feel that my child is smart, so he doesn't need to study. And if he studied maybe in school, it's enough for him.
Yeah.
Now he can do his other activities. Studying is a part of life that really has a lot of benefits for that particular time and the future of the child also.
It makes a person hardworking.
Yeah, and effort-based.
Yeah.
Not the fact that he wants an outcome,
Very true.
So this should be looked
through. That process, you know.
Yeah, the process of studying, the heart. Even in Quran it says, لَيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى. And that's that sa'i and that, that putting your effort into. That's very important. In every field, if you go and see, Allah looks at that effort put into, not the outcome. The outcome is with Allah totally.
Exactly.
And it's impossible that you don't get your fruits. You know, you get somehow or the other, that kind of achievement, that even that happiness when you take effort, that happiness. So now it's teaching the parent to even, you know, encourage the child in this way. We'll look through it, you know, as we go on with our program.
Yes.
Another factor could be that his lack of concentration in studying. You know, some children are hyperactive. So they have a problem. Now, in this, to solve this problem, one has to go to visit a psychiatrist or maybe even solve the problem. You know, give him some small activities at a time and improve his concentration. So how do you know this problem exists? When you just enroll a child in the first grade.
Yeah.
And when they are too small, usually it's playing. Okay. So that's okay. Even at that time, you can realize that if your child is hyperactive or not. But as they grow in grade 1, grade 2, you can know, do they have that concentration span? Are they concentrating properly in their activities, in their subjects? Then you can notice and ask the teacher about it or the person who is in charge that, you know, how your child is probably not studying well or not feeling like studying. So you'll get this probably encountered that the child is having a problem in paying attention.
Right.
So how we can improve this attention span of his by giving him small activities at a time, helping him to study. And we'll look through it, how to, enhance this proper studying and better studying in a child.
Perfect. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. Inshallah, that we are able to work with our children in this way.
Yeah.
And we will continue this, inshallah, in the next episode. Dear audience, thank you very much for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.